The first case for oral argument this morning is the State of South Dakota versus Nicole Marie Mulligan, Mulligan being the appellant. Attorneys for Appellant Mulligan are Mr. Richard Summers and Ms. Melissa Neville from Aberdeen, and for the appellee State of South Dakota, Mr. Gary Campbell. Mr. Summers, I understand you'll be presenting the argument this morning. Okay. You may proceed, counsel, and you have 20 minutes.
May it please the court and counsel. In preparing for the hearing today, I reviewed the court summary of facts, or the little pamphlet that was handed out, and I think that for purposes, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on facts, but I want to emphasize the fact that two additional facts that are important. One is when this shooting took place on October 15th, Nicole and Richard were not the only people in the house. There was another adult by the name of Bob Rivera in the house. He was a friend of Richard's and a friend of Nicole's. The house is very small. The house would fit inside this courtroom area. Mr. Rivera testified that nothing unusual happened. There was no fighting. There was nothing going on. In addition to Mr. Rivera, the couple's son was there. Another additional fact that I think is important as it relates to our argument and the insufficiency of the evidence is that one of the first EMTs on the scene, a fellow by the name of Larry Wimmer, arrived at that scene and asked Richard, who was quite conscious, who everybody thought he was going to live that night, in fact, what happened. Or he didn't even ask him what happened. He said, "How's it going, Richard?" Because he was a friend of Richard's. And Richard said, "It was an accident. It was an accident." That was his response. Not that she shot me, not that she did anything wrong, that it was an accident. This becomes important, and there were three other individuals that Richard told that it was an accident that night. One was Dr. Collins, who unfortunately had testified or had died prior to the trial, and law enforcement had lost his written statement. It was nowhere to be found. It was one of many items that were lost in this case by law enforcement. But Dr. Collins, a nurse by the name of Joanne Carter, and another nurse by the name of Joyce Nischwitz, all were told by Richard repeatedly that night that this was an accident, that she was handing me the gun and it went off. I wanted to make those two points before getting into the legal issues. Obviously, our first issue deals with the insufficiency of the evidence. I think that Judge Lovren pretty much summed up the state of the evidence at this trial when, at the time of settling jury instructions, he stated, and his statement is found at page 1590 of the trial transcript, "Here the choice is either an accidental shooting, or premeditated killing." In other words, it was an accident, excusable homicide, or it was a murder. This case was tried by the state.
Did you object to the lesser included?
We did not. We had tried to, we had moved to have the first degree manslaughter stricken, the charge. We'd moved for a directed verdict and were denied. So we did not, it was not a lesser included instruction given or upon request by the state, but it was merely one of the charges that was charged.
It was charged out in the alternative.
Correct.
Okay. Well, now, you have brought out these facts to us this morning, but you got to also bring them out to the jury, and it didn't carry the day. Why is it different here today?
I think it did carry the day, Your Honor, and I will tell you why. If the court reviews the questions that were sent out by the jury, and I was going to get to that, but they sent out a series of questions on the second day of deliberations, all of which talked about a lawful act. And the questions dealt primarily with negligence. And can someone commit a lawful act, and if someone dies, does that equal criminal intent? Or does if someone commits a lawful act without usual and ordinary caution, does that equal criminal intent? The jury was instructed on the criminal intent element of first-degree manslaughter, and clearly they were struggling with that. They were not finding any criminal intent. And quite frankly, that's because the state tried this case as basically an execution type of killing, which the jury clearly did not believe. So,
but the jury was correctly instructed in response to that question. The jury was given the appropriate answer about justifiable homicide, and that does involve a lawful act, which could be accidental. So the jury, the response that was given to the jury was correct, was it not?
I think the correct response would have been no, that you cannot commit a lawful act and have it rise to criminal intent.
That's what the judge did. Isn't that what the judge did by referring the jury to the instruction that says if it's a accidental act, it's not murder?
Correct.
So the jury considered the issue and rejected it?
I don't think they rejected it. I don't think they understood it, Your Honor. That's our position. There was no evidence to show that there was any criminal intent. There was evidence to show that there was negligence at best.
See, that brings us to the fundamental problem. You don't think the jury interpreted the law correctly, but the presumption, the legal presumption is that the jury did. We have to presume the jury did the right thing.
I think that ordinarily I would agree with you, but in this case we have that series of questions, and I assume for purposes of today's argument the court has reviewed those questions sent out by the jury. It was clear what the jury was thinking, and that this was a negligent act, and they were almost going around in a circle, that they couldn't find any criminal intent, but they couldn't get past the fact that somebody had died.
Isn't it a little disingenuous, though, to come to this court and say, well, it was either murder or it was an accident, knowing full well we can't reinstate a murder conviction?
There was never enough evidence for a murder conviction, Your Honor.
But you said you agreed with Judge Lovren's that it was either murder or it was an accident.
I think that Judge Lovren was commenting on the state of the evidence as we were settling instructions, that there was either a murder, the jury would have to find that there was either a murder or that there was an accident. And, you know, and frankly, excuse me, nobody discussed first-degree manslaughter. Nobody argued it. Nobody discussed it. Mr. Wager, my trial counsel, co-counsel, dealt with it in closing, that there had been no evidence of that. And it was never discussed. What we have here, quite frankly, is a case where I think that this court is called upon to decide whether negligence with a firearm is always going to be manslaughter in the first degree. You know, and this court has never decided that issue. If you look at the first-degree manslaughter cases that are out there, whether they be State versus Bertzloff, State versus Clothier, those were cases where somebody intended to shoot someone. There's no question about it that the person, the defendant that was charged and convicted of first-degree manslaughter, pointed a gun at someone and intentionally shot him.
You know, earlier you indicated you were telling us what jury thought, and maybe based on the questions that they asked, that may have been correct at one time, but that was before the final verdict of the jury. And how do we know the final verdict of the jury isn't a decision that, well, there is enough here for manslaughter?
Admittedly, you wouldn't know that, but I think that this court is called upon all the time to review jury verdicts and judicial verdicts as to what the state of the evidence is. This case has no evidence of anything that would reach the level of first-degree manslaughter.
Well, what about the fact that there was expert testimony that it would have taken 4 pounds of pressure to pull the trigger on that gun?
Well, there was expert testimony regarding whether the gun would have been stored in single-action mode or double-action mode. And I believe, in all fairness to the court, that in double-action mode, it would have taken around 11 pounds of pressure. In single-action, it would have taken about 4 pounds of pressure. There's no question that in this house, every gun in the house was loaded. Richard was a paranoid individual that thought somebody was going to break into his house. The bottom line there, Justice, and I have no other answer than that guns are involved in accidental killings all too frequently, and nobody has an explanation for what happens, but it happens. If this gun was in single action mode, in other words, if it had been cocked, and one of the witnesses testified that Richard kept the gun ready to pop, that was his terminology, it would have taken very little pressure. 4 pounds sounds like a lot, but if you hold that gun and pull the trigger, it's not much at all.
And then what about the evidence that she'd been stealing from him to the tune of $37,000? He was a credit freak that never wanted to buy anything on credit, and he was about ready to kick her and her child out of the house.
Well, that's not correct. They had some fights about money. Nicole was managing to pay that, and in fact, that was the case, the state's whole case. This case, the primary evidence introduced at this case was the spending by Nicole. And in fact, I would tell you that that's all the case was a case of motive. And the state's brief and the testimony introduced at trial are somewhat misleading on that. The officer testified that she could not make the minimum monthly payments. The only problem with this testimony was he calculated that, and his testimony was based upon payments that were required to be made several months after Richard died, after all the evidence was seized and she was no longer able to resell the eBay items. She was making the payments. And again, I would tell you, this court, that in this small house, there were crates of items that she was buying and selling on eBay. He had to know what was going on. It just would have been impossible not to have.
One question. If there's enough evidence for murder, is it improper for the jury to compromise and give the defendant a break, especially when there's instructions for manslaughter by the court?
I think that we should never have a compromise verdict. The state argued at sentencing that this was a compromise verdict. And if the court is asking, did my client actually get the benefit of some type of compromise, I would disagree. I don't think that she got the benefit of anything. I think that this jury was confused as to the standard that applied and were hung up on the fact that it was a dangerous weapon and that somebody died. I think that compromise verdicts are never appropriate. I think they're instructed as the same. It's interesting that the state prosecutor, Mr. Russman, did argue at sentencing that this was probably a compromise verdict. But there still has to be a basis in fact. They did not have enough to convict her of first-degree murder.
What if there's enough evidence for murder? Can the jury give the defendant a break and have mercy on the defendant and convict for manslaughter?
You know, if they're to follow the instructions, no. I mean, I think that I don't think that it's the jury's province to give a break and convict of manslaughter. Our position is that she should not have been convicted of anything. There was not enough evidence for murder.
If you say the jury did not understand the instructions, are you asking for a new trial or are you asking for an outright acquittal?
Well, obviously we'd be asking for a reversal on the judgment of conviction, and whether that's a new trial or whether that's an outright acquittal would remain with this court. Obviously we would prefer an outright acquittal, but I don't know that that's necessarily what this court would do. I want to get back to Justice Zinter's question about the money aspect of it. This money aspect was the state's primary. We spent days on the charges, and so much time was spent on that. And I want you to understand that we never defended those charges. We did not deal with those issues. We did not try to present any kind of evidence or any type of testimony regarding Richard's knowledge of what or was not going on, because it really wasn't relevant to our case. But it was effective, and it may have misled the jury. In fact, I would submit to you that it was so effective that it misled a seasoned trial judge, Judge Lovren, who sat with this court on numerous occasions, into handing down what's clearly a portion of a sentence, which is illegal, ordering restitution on those amounts. I don't even think the state contests the fact that those amounts, that restitution order regarding what Judge Lovren referred to as thefts from Richard, is an illegal sentence, or at least that portion of the sentence is illegal. And so that had some effect.
During trial or during the sentencing hearing, did you object to that, or was that objected to, the restitution part of it?
Not at the hearing. That had never been raised, and actually it came up. The state didn't ask for it. It came up in Judge Lovren's oral pronouncement of the sentence.
Okay. So the state never even requested it?
Nobody asked for that, no. And in fact, there would have been no reason to. I don't think anybody expected that to be part of the sentence. But it had an effect on this judge, this seasoned trial judge. It certainly could have had an effect on the jury, thinking that she needs to be punished for something. But if a fair review of this evidence, the fact that Mr. Golddaddy lived for 4 hours, told numerous people that it was an accident, that she was handing the gun to him and it went off, which is consistent with what she told law enforcement. Nicole had no way of knowing what Richard was telling.
Well, with all due respect to the decedent, he wouldn't know what was going on in her mind, whether she intended to merely hand the gun to him or intended to pull the trigger. That was only her mind would have given us that answer, right?
No, he did. He told people. Well, okay, I see what you're saying subjectively, that she would have been the only person that would have known what her intent was. I think, though, Your Honor, that in all fairness, if my wife comes up with a gun and is handing it to me, I'm going to know if she's shooting me or handing it to me.
I don't think we want to go down this road.
Probably not. But you can't ignore the fact that nobody disputed that he kept these guns loaded, that there was a child in the house, and that she came upon this gun at some point in time and wanted to get rid of it. I want to talk a little bit about the Batson issue, especially. We went to trial in Walworth County, and my partner and I fully expected, and we're not surprised, when the state struck all the Native American jurors about halfway through their peremptory challenges, all of them. Frankly, if you practice law, which Justice Gilbertson clearly did in the Fifth Circuit, especially on the East End and the West End, race is always going to be an issue when it comes to picking a jury and perceptions. We expected the state to use their peremptory challenges to strike Native American jurors, and they did. And they did it rather quickly. Now, I know the state in their brief is alleging that there were all kinds of reasons for that, some of which were not articulated by the prosecutors at that point in time. But all those fail, in our opinion. They do not reach the level of passing muster according to the U.S. Supreme Court decisions. As pointed out in our brief, the argument by the state that a couple of the Native American jurors or potential jurors were young mothers and had young children. Well, guess what? We had younger mothers with younger children. They happened to be white that were sat at the jury. We had one Native American gentleman that the state struck on the basis that they thought that he didn't have the mental capacity or grammatical skills to be a juror. He answered one question.
2 minutes.
Pardon?
2 minutes.
He answered one question on that issue. That's all he answered. They never questioned him about any of that. Batson and the Supreme Court cases that follow that make it clear that that type of behavior is not to be tolerated and is grounds for reversal. The Eighth Circuit or the federal court recently granted a writ of habeas on this very same issue. They did not bounce one, two, or three of the Native American jurors. They bounced all of them, and they bounced them early. Now, we were comfortable with Native American juries, and the basis of our lawsuit, or of our defense, was the inappropriateness of the police behavior in this case. And I'm not going to have time to get into that, but I can tell you from practicing for 23 years in that area that there is a certain skepticism built in with Native Americans and law enforcement. And we felt that it was important to have that segment of the general population in Walworth County represented on that jury. And the state clearly felt that it was important to their case that they not have them. And that in and of itself is basis for reversal of this conviction and a new trial. That would require a new trial. Now, we asked for that. We asked that those jurors remain seated on the jury. And Judge Lovren initially had it right, said, well, we haven't completely seated the jury yet. What do you guys want to happen? And we said, we want those people placed back on the jury, and the state should exercise some other peremptories. And the state simply took...
I didn't see you, though, at the end of the jury selection where you could actually compare the number of young mothers that were Caucasian and the number that were Native American. I didn't see you ask to have that comparison made at that time. Instead, it looked to me like you passed the jury for cause at that point.
We did not, and we did not do that for the simple reason that the court had indicated that it was that it would be willing to do that, and instead the state said, we're willing to live with this jury if it goes up on appeal. And so we assume the record was made.
Your time has expired, counsel. Thank you. Mr. Campbell, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor, and I thank the court for this opportunity to present the state's case here. Now, the defendant here, of course, raises four arguments: insufficiency of the evidence to support first-degree manslaughter, validity of the restitution order, whether there were there was a reversal is warranted because of a Batson violation for a deliberate discrimination against Native American prospective jurors, and lastly, it was a spoliation of evidence issue. Now, spoliation of evidence issue was never touched in the defendant's main argument, so I don't intend to address that unless the court has questions about it. I'll begin with the insufficiency of the evidence argument, and the state disagrees with much of the spin that the defense is putting on this case.
Well, you know, and I've not read the record, but when I read the briefs, that thought struck me right away too, that this is either murder or it's not guilty. How can you hold a gun 2 feet away from somebody and it goes off and you say, I didn't intend to kill them? Well,
right.
You either intended to kill them or it was an accident, isn't it?
Well, not legally, I don't think. Under Bertzlaff, Bertzlaff was another case where it was perfectly clear in my mind that it was an intentional murder. She says, I'm going to shoot you. She shoots him from 5 or 6 feet away. And later on claims, well, I didn't intend to kill him, and I don't remember carrying the gun. Now, there you've clearly got evidence of first-degree murder, intentional, first-degree, premeditated murder. Yet, the court said that it was sufficient when she said that she didn't intend to kill him and that she didn't remember carrying the gun, that that was enough to put first-degree manslaughter before the jury. I think the idea is it's similar to a defendant being entitled to jury instructions on a defense where there's any evidence to support it. Is there any evidence in this case to support first-degree manslaughter? Well, she's claiming all along that it's an accident. Yet the evidence indicates that the state's evidence, in the state's view, and I understand that's my spin, but there's very strong evidence here that that gun would not have gone off by itself, which is the crux of their defense. 4 pounds of pressure is required even in the single action mode, which is the easier to fire. Get 4 pounds of sugar in a bag, dangle it from your finger. It's a heavy weight. And that analogy was used during the trial. You have her in the room within 2 feet of him, and according to the state's evidence, I believe that there's certainly enough there to find beyond reasonable doubt that she fired that bullet. She affirmatively fired it. Now, at a 2 foot range, you don't need much aiming. Now, what is in her head, we frankly don't know. I think there's a very strong case here that she intended to kill him to hide the financial difficulties that she was in. And regarding that, I don't intend to spend a lot of time on that issue, but the evidence was that at the time she killed him, she had rolled up $37,000 in debt on his credit cards. She had changed the addresses on those credit cards to a P.O. box. Why? To hide the fact she was stealing from him. That's the only thing that comes through. people that knew him, including his brother, testify that he was a very frugal man. He did not spend on credit. What he would do is he would save up his money, and then he would pay in cash. He used a credit card only for gasoline. In that context, and also where his relatives and friends testify that he would be very angry if money was taken from him and he didn't know about it. In this situation, where she has essentially carried out identity theft, hijacked two of his credit cards, run up $37,000 in debt. And this is on top of $400, $460 a month, I believe, that was being deducted by a debt consolidation outfit. She's paying $1,000 a month to meet minimum payments, and the previous year she made $17,000. She may have made more the next year. That's not clear in the record. But you're talking about somebody who is not able, really, she's not able to meet her payments without using the one credit card to pay off the other. And by the time...
How does any of that differentiate between first-degree murder and manslaughter?
Oh, very clearly. If in a situation where someone is stealing from another, the other one doesn't know it, the other one is about to learn it because he is intending to buy a property outside town and build a house, as soon as someone takes a look at his credit rating, he is right down the tubes. So she's looking at impending discovery of her actions. They'd had previous, at least on two or three previous occasions, there were indications that he wanted her to move out. In, I believe, September of 1982, 2 months before he was killed, she's out looking for a house.
2002, you mean?
Excuse me?
2002.
Right. Yes, Your Honor. Thanks for the correction. In that situation, she's got motive to kill him. And when she is in, okay, she's in the house. There's a man, friend working on her computer in another room. Her three-year-old son is in the other room with the man on the computer. And she supposedly is carrying the gun up to him because she wants him to move the gun. Well, the people in the other room, the man working on the computer, the family friend, didn't hear any discussion of the gun. Yet, the gun goes off. She isn't bringing up whether she wants him to move the gun. And you look at that, and you look at her changing stories. You look at the contradictions of her stories. Whether the gun is wrapped in a towel or not, she changes her story in the interviews when she's confronted with Agent Braley discussing the burn patterns on towels. You have her claiming that, I knew that the gun was there, but that was a year ago and I'd forgotten about it and I just stumbled across it when I'm going to get the towels because I want to wash the dog. Well, fine, except that I believe it was either Mr. Golddaddy's brother or one of his close friends who testified that, no, they'd been talking about it a few months before, that very issue. And yet all of a sudden, no, she didn't remember the gun was there. You have testimony that he put the gun up there specifically for her use in case there was an intruder. And that witness went on to say that, he would have told her how to operate that gun. He's a gun collector, expert, however you want to say it. Is it conceivable that he would put a gun up there for a specific purpose of her use and not have her know how to use the gun? That's a jury question. There's clearly enough here. In this scenario where she shoots him to death at a distance of 2 feet, where there's evidence that that gun would not have gone off, that it was a well-designed gun, it was in good working order, it had an internal safety or transfer bar, I believe, which would prevent it firing. Even if you just pulled the trigger back, unless you held it for half a second or so, it would not go off. You have to have the pull, you have to have maintaining the pressure. In that situation, the jury could well believe, beyond reasonable doubt, that she intentionally shot that gun. Now, if you're shooting a gun 2 feet away from somebody and the gun is pointed at him and it kills him, I don't think there's too much question that that could be first-degree manslaughter. First-degree manslaughter requires a homicide without a design to effect death but by means of a dangerous weapon. Now, here you do have a homicide. You have, according to her story, which doesn't have to be believed, but could be, that she did not intend to shoot him. She didn't intend to kill him. Well, that puts first-degree manslaughter into play. The jury doesn't have to buy the part of her story where she says she didn't intend to shoot or that she didn't shoot. The state's evidence covers that aspect. The other part of it is she's saying that she didn't intend the result. Well, that puts it into first-degree manslaughter just like in Burtzloff.
Isn't it a stretch, though, to shoot somebody in the stomach at a distance of 2 feet with a .357 and say, I didn't intend to kill him?
Well, it's the same with Burtzloff. I think you get into whether it's one of those situations, is there enough evidence? And in Burtzloff, this court said yes. And I think the same is true here. And there are screwy scenarios, or maybe not so screwy, but, you know, there are scenarios where she might have intended to scare him because her story was that it's simply the safety of the child. Well, what better way to make your point than discharge a gun right in front of him, oh, by accident? That was a suggestion that Agent Braley had brought up during his interview, one of his interviews with her. Could she have intended to wound him and put him out of commission so that he wouldn't be buying the house, and therefore she's not discovered with her thefts? Those are possible, and I think they would have been viable justifications for the verdict. But
I want to ask you some questions about the jury makeup and the fact that the state bumped all the Native Americans off the jury. Isn't that something that we should be concerned about?
Absolutely.
So is this all right, then?
Well, I think you can be concerned about it and not necessarily find that there's an intentional pattern of discrimination. When you, under Batson and Miller L., and I apologize to the court for the introduction to my part of that issue in my brief, because I looked at Batson and it says if you're a minority and they take off the minority prospective jurors, that isn't a requirement. And it doesn't matter what race you are. What matters is if there's a pattern of discrimination against a particular race or whatever of prospective jurors. And in my brief where I said that we did not contest there was a prima facie case, I was basically acknowledging that. Under Batson and Miller L. and subsequent cases, the first part of the analysis is whether the defense makes a prima facie case. And I think where the state takes off most or all of a particular race, that's a prima facie case. The burden then goes to the state. The state has to show that they were struck for non-discriminatory purposes. And in this case, I think regarding each one of those jurors, the state put forth race-neutral reasons, whether it was bias, whether it was prejudice, whether it was low intelligence, whether it was sympathy for the defendant or a person in her position.
Defense counsel says that just a moment ago that you brought up reasons that the prosecutor didn't raise. Now, what's your response to that?
I think they're being hyper-technical and, frankly, disingenuous. If you look at the brief, what I was trying to do is point. I set forth the reasons, and I go back to the record and try to show where those things turn up. Now, I think the specific complaint was that regarding Mr. Garreau, I believe it was, that it was his low intelligence they were concerned with. And I cited the part where he's talking about, well, I know him, and all he does is lie mostly. Well, I think one complicating factor is that he's examined somewhat on the previous page. He gives some responses, but it only identifies him as a juror. It doesn't identify him by name. So that's, you know, I think the court really is kind of stuck there because the record is not complete.
Does it trouble you at all that the prosecutor said that with respect to a couple of these jurors that he didn't even know they were Native American?
No, it doesn't.
And yet their names were common Native American names in that community. That didn't strike you as odd?
I can't really answer that, because those very same names are given to whites also. I know it's very common for French names to be used by Native Americans. But the thing is, the trial court is in a position to judge the character, demeanor, abilities of the prospective jurors. He's also there to observe the attorneys. And he can make a judgment far better than this court can as to whether those were credible. And that's why this court reviews that issue under the clear error, clearly erroneous standard, because of the judge's opportunity to observe. As to what these people's physical features are, I don't know. And I know the defense will stand up there and say, oh, it's obvious to me. Yeah, but he can't testify here about that. That is not, he says it on the record in the argument regarding the Batson motion, but the judge was there to hear that. He was there to see that.
Our review is clearly erroneous. Is
yes,
that
Your Honor.
Not abuse of discretion? Not abuse of discretion. Is it clearly erroneous?
Clearly erroneous.
So the findings that the trial court made on the record, we have to look at that in relationship to the evidence in the record to determine whether or not it's clearly erroneous.
Yes, Your Honor. Clearly erroneous basically it's founded on the trial court's observation of the situation. And clearly erroneous is a very high standard to have to meet. As far as the race, I don't think that is determinative, though. The determinative facts here are the reasons given. I don't think there's you could look at the that's obviously an absurd answer, but the trial judge didn't find that so. And the trial judge made a finding during the discussion of what the remedy would be for the problem, if there was a problem. The trial judge said that he would note that there was the Batson motion had been made, and that there was no pattern of purposeful discrimination. I mean, that's right there in the transcript. The judge flat out rejected what the defense is arguing. And the reasons given are not pretextual. They're based on contacts with the police. They're based on knowing the defendant or defendant and the victim, knowing the defendant and the victim's family. You have the Garreau saying that one of the witnesses is a flat-out liar. You have one of the women saying that she wouldn't go to that doctor if she had a common cold, and basically she didn't like him. And she didn't trust him. You can't force the state to go to trial with jurors that are not going to give it a fair break, or if there is a reason with foundation. And that is present here regarding all of those strikes. I think that, it's an issue that the court has to look at. It has to take very seriously. And the trial court was taking it seriously, too.
2 minutes, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. Oh, and I did see the light, surely. The trial court had a considerable discussion with the counsel about what to do, how to take care of this. And I think it was Mr. Wager, not Mr. Summers, who piped up that, he'd be glad to have the state withdraw its peremptories and allow these five to sit on the jury. Well, I think if you look at these jurors, you know why he wants to do it. It's not because they're Native American, as he says now. He wants them because they're going to be favorable to his case. And I don't think the state can be required by the Constitution to sabotage its own case.
I have another question before your time is up about the restitution.
Yes, sir.
When I read your brief, it appeared that at least you, to a certain extent, recognize that that may have been a problem, that the judge just sua sponte ordered restitution, that perhaps it could, at the least, it should be remanded?
I think it should at least be remanded. My memory, and I didn't bring the sentencing transcript with me, but and I rely on the record whether this is true or not, but my memory was that the state did mention restitution in its sentencing argument. I might be wrong. I think here where there was no objection at any point, I think either it's waived and you affirm it without remand, or you remand it back for another look. Either one of those, I think, would be appropriate here. You can't just raise on appeal issues that were never raised below. And there's clearly an opportunity to at least request a hearing under the case law cited. If there are no further questions, I would ask that this court affirm her conviction of first-degree manslaughter. The evidence was there. I think the evidence was much stronger for first-degree murder, just as in Birdsloff, but there was enough to put that charge before the jury, and there was enough for the jury to find it. Now, the defense
Your
is
time
claiming.
Has expired, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. Okay.
Mr. Summers, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you. The clear distinction between Birdsloff and this case is that in Birdsloff, she intended to kill him. She intended to shoot the gun, and that was the criminal intent that was required for purposes of finding her guilty. If there is no intent to kill Richard Goldady, which the jury clearly rejected, and there's no criminal intent. There has to be some criminal intent. The court instructs the jury that there must be criminal intent in order to convict of first-degree manslaughter. If you look at those questions, the jury's talking about, does a lawful act ever become a criminal act if not done with usual and ordinary caution? They're talking about negligence. No criminal intent is in this record. There's nothing to base a first-degree manslaughter charge on. I would submit to the court that if I were here appealing a first-degree murder conviction on the basis that we did not get a lesser-included instruction, this court would tell me there's no basis in fact for a lesser-included instruction on first-degree manslaughter, because there isn't. It's just not there in this record. And the state,
aren't you kind of playing both sides against the middle then by not objecting to the lesser included instruction? You're like trying to take advantage of it, and yet you want the benefit of the fact that it was given.
No, Your Honor, we're not trying to do that. In fact, I think that, I don't remember if it's on the record, and I hate to speak out of turn, I think that there actually was discussion of having second degree manslaughter, and we didn't request that, the reckless killing. The reason that we were stuck with first degree manslaughter, and we tried to kick it out on several occasions, was because the state charged it out that way. I don't know why the state, Mr. Todd, charged it out that way, but that's the way it was charged out, and that's what we were stuck with. So we had to have the instructions in there once the judge failed to direct a verdict on first-degree manslaughter. Agent Braley testified that if this was not an intentional killing, if it wasn't murder, that my client did nothing wrong, that the way she handled that gun was appropriate. That was his testimony. That's consistent with the evidence. She had her left hand on the gun. She was handing him the gun. There was all kinds of different testimony by law enforcement that was proven to be incorrect. But, I specifically asked him, if this was not an execution-style killing, if this was truly an accident, did Nicole do anything wrong? And he said no. The way that she handled the gun would have been appropriate for somebody that doesn't know how to handle a gun. So at best, we have my client, Nicole, was negligent. Maybe she shouldn't have touched the gun that day. I cannot find any cases, and I should say that Melissa can't find any cases, regarding this issue of whether negligence rises to a standard that would support a first-degree manslaughter conviction. I do not believe it does. I think the distinction between first-degree manslaughter and second-degree manslaughter as it relates to a dangerous weapon is because it is a dangerous weapon, and there probably is a higher standard of care. but at least would have to reach some type of reckless behavior on her part in order for a first-degree manslaughter conviction to apply under these facts. And she wasn't reckless. At best, she was negligent. As it relates to the state's discussion on Batson, I don't think, you know, the court law or the Supreme Court law makes it clear that you can't come back after the fact and set forth reasons in your brief after you've had a chance to review the transcript and handpick reasons that now you think was a legitimate reason for striking, a race-neutral reason for striking jurors. There was no question that these five individuals were Native Americans. Mr. Wager and I are from the same community as Mr. Russman and Mr. McNary. We certainly knew that they were Native Americans.
Did you ask them?
No.
So how did you know?
Appearances, Your Honor.
What?
Appearances and names.
Well, being from Sisseton, I know a lot of blonde, blue-eyed Indians that are enrolled members of the tribe. I think that's a very dangerous way to attempt to identify people.
There was testimony by several of them that they worked for the BIA and that their brothers were tribal policemen.
So you have nothing in the record to establish any of these five people are Native Americans other than your own say-so?
No, we have the clerk of courts who testified that for 25 years that these people were all Native Americans and were well known in the community as being Native Americans. That's what she testified to. The Batson challenge is important. Now, to say that the state didn't know is disingenuous. They knew. To say that their reasons are not pretextual is disingenuous. To say that we kicked Lynette Logg off and Effie Thompson because they were young mothers with young children, that's not true, because there were young mothers with young children on there.
Let me interrupt you there, because one of the reasons given for one of them was that this particular person had prior law enforcement problems. Now, that's got to be a legitimate reason for the state to remove a juror. I mean, the state isn't going to want somebody that's been picked up by the police before.
That was one of them. That was Lynette Logg.
Isn't that satisfactory?
I don't remember.
To satisfy Batson, anyway.
Just Senator, I don't know if that was a reason given by them at the time of the hearing. I know that it was given in the brief. They certainly did not try to challenge her for cause on that basis. They never mentioned that. The same would go with Rita Ducheneau. I will concede that Rita Ducheneau had a brother that was killed in a shooting accident, but the state did not try and challenge her for cause on that basis. Instead, they used their peremptory challenges just to strike Native Americans as a whole. And I think that, I don't know what their reasoning was, but clearly their stated reasons are not sufficient under Batson and Miller L. In summary, our position is that, and I know I haven't even addressed some of the issues, but there is no evidence in this record to support a first-degree manslaughter conviction. There is evidence to support the fact that my client was negligent at best, and that negligence is not something that we put people in jail for. Gun accidents happen every day. It happened to Nicole at a bad time. The state, as Mr. Campbell did just now, tried this case on the basis of credit card charges. They still want to talk about the credit card charges. If the state wanted to charge her with that type of theft, they could have. They did not. They provided a case of motive for first-degree murder. The jury did not accept that motive. The jury did not accept that argument that this was a first-degree murder case. They put no evidence on that would be any type of evidence that would support a first-degree manslaughter conviction. As it relates to the Batson challenge, the record is clear. This is a Walworth County case. The state comes in, strikes all the Native Americans, every Native American on the panel. Now they've drummed up some reasons why they did that, but you can't get past that, and you can't get
2 minutes, Mr. Simers.
You can't get past those constitutional requirements, and especially coming in late after the fact and arguing, nitpicking the record to say, well, here's a reason, here's a reason, here's a reason, and yet they never tried to challenge for cause on any of those reasons. So.
So is it, you agree we have to look at what the trial court, the findings of the trial court at the time that, that you raised that issue initially to determine whether or not he was clearly erroneous?
I believe that you have to look at those to see if they're contextual, yes, and to see if the court was right in its ruling on that.
Based on what he had in front of him at the time?
Correct, and based on what the state said, not upon what Mr. Gamble puts in his brief after the fact.
On that issue, one other question. You've suggested a couple of times the reasons weren't valid because they didn't challenge for cause. You're not suggesting that's a legal requirement?
No.
That you have to challenge for cause before you can use a preempt and still satisfy Batson?
No. Obviously, on preempts, you can use those for whatever reason you feel sufficient other than race or gender, and that's what the state did in this case. We're urging the court to reverse and remand an outright acquittal on the first-degree manslaughter. The state can bring her to trial on some type of credit card theft if they think that's appropriate. We did not defend that case. We could have defended that case. That's the case that the state wants to talk about. And therefore, we're urging that this court, and respectfully request that this court, reverse the conviction, and certainly at a minimum, reverse the judgment of restitution. That can't be made whole. She was never given an opportunity to defend that. And so, therefore, any order of restitution is improper under prior case holdings. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Summers.